because we can do this for you.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful. Thanks. That's great.
We're delighted to see two sets of people here. Firstly, you, the audience, who UCT values immensely as one of the quality checks on the level of ideas which we talk about, think about, and profess at the university. Although we cannot claim the excellence of what you've already heard, many of you, in talking about Newton in the preceding set of lectures last week, nor what's to come this afternoon and in the future, because Professor Wolf is not, regrettably, one of us. But we have bagged him to give an opening set of lectures on electricity to our first year students in 2 weeks from now. So David Wolf, you will see, is a man of many parts. A research physicist, PhD at the University of Pennsylvania. For many years, a professor and ultimately head of department at the University of New Mexico in America. Running a successful research group in antimatter at the CERN laboratory in Geneva. But of more interest to us tonight is his ability to explain and to inspire and to make real some of the more abstruse ideas in physics which are so fascinating. He's taught, of course, both at university level, but more interestingly, recently in England, at a high school where his interest in particular in encouraging women to come into science were at the fore. He was so successful at this that the bureaucrats said, you can't teach at an English high school, you only are a university professor. You don't have the diploma. It took the intervention of the Minister of Education to put that right. But I invite you tonight, you to be the judge of how interesting, inspiring, and excellent a person David Wolf is. With no further ado, I turn over to you, David.
Thank you. I'm embarrassed by introductions like that, but I'll get started so I can forget all that stuff. I came out yesterday, the last 3 days, for a lecture at 6 o'clock, and given the state of traffic coming out from Cape Town, I'm astonished that there's anybody here at 6 o'clock at all. However, I'm grateful to you for being here. Now, I want to talk tonight about a man who I find very fascinating, Thomas Young. And I'll tell you how I came to this, because I moved to London a little over 10 years ago, immediately following the birth of the most talented, intelligent, and beautiful young girl, my granddaughter, since the birth of her own mother. Anyway, I quickly discovered that London has many more advantages besides just my granddaughter, and one of the biggest one was my discovery of Wigmore Hall. Wigmore Hall is the best venue, I am absolutely sure, for chamber music in the world. It has remarkably excellent chamber music 7 days a week, 11 months out of the year, and I'm there 3-4 nights a week for the last 10 years. Now, usually when I go there, I take the public transport, but when the weather is really grotty in England, I sometimes drive. And when I drive, you can park on Welbeck Street around the corner, and if you arrive after 7 o'clock, you can park for free, so I do. And then I walk down Welbeck Street, and I passed, every time I'm there, I pass this lovely White House with a big blue plaque on it, and those of you who have been to London know that these blue plaques mean something historically important. And it said on there, Thomas Young, man of science, lived here. And now I looked at that and I smiled, because every beginning physics student knows Thomas Young, the man who demonstrated that light has a wave-like character. But man of science, I mean, he's a physicist. I didn't know he was generally involved in science. So I started reading about him, and I became fascinated about him because he's a truly remarkable person, and that's what I want to talk to you about tonight. So we'll start with Young was born in 1773 in a small town called Milverton in the county of Somerset in the southwest of England. He was the eldest of 10 children, so he was, and he was born in a Quaker family. He died 55 years later in London in 1829. And despite the fact that he was a rather staid and calm person, he did at least seem to have a sense of humor, because as the oldest of 10 children, he made a pun on his name, Thomas Young, by saying that he had been born old and died young. He was a remarkable polymath. A polymath is defined by the Oxford English Dictionary as a person of much or varied learning, one acquainted with various subjects of study. It comes from the Greek word polymathos, meaning having learned much, and this is certainly true. Today we might use the term, at least for a man, of Renaissance man. But in our modern age of specialization, a polymath is often considered a dilettante or an amateur or somebody who is not serious enough about a subject to really specialize in learning a great deal about it. But I think that's an anachronistic definition applying our modern standards to old times. Young was a remarkable prodigy his entire life, and he was almost entirely self-taught. And here is a statement from him with which I disagree a great deal. Written by a 25-year-old Thomas Young, that you don't need teachers, you can learn everything you want from by yourself. Now, raised in this rather devout Quaker family, he was a quiet and reserved man throughout his life, even though he left the Quaker religion in his mid-20s, became an Anglican, married a non-Quaker woman, etc. But he was a remarkable prodigy as a child, and I have a quote from that famous science fiction author, Isaac Asimov, about the best kind of infant prodigy, the kind that becomes an adult prodigy. To show you what an amazing prodigy he was, he could read fluently by age 2. Now, most children cannot talk really very well by age 2. He could read. By the age 4, he had read the Bible through cover to cover twice, Old and New Testament. By age 6, between 4 and 6, he was memorizing poetry, both in English and Latin, despite the fact that his Latin was still a little weak by the time he was 5 years old. He was able to recite, about on his 6th birthday, Oliver Goldsmith's Deserted Village. Now, Deserted Village is a lovely poem. I remember reading it at school, but I haven't read it since that, and that's about 150 years ago. So I went and I looked it up, and it doesn't have just one little stanza. It's over 500 lines in length. This 5-year-old or 6-year-old kid knew it off by heart. Quite remarkable. By age 13, he had taught himself Hebrew. He taught himself Hebrew by buying a Bible in Hebrew, the Old Testament, reading the book of Genesis first in Hebrew and then in English, and comparing the two languages, taught himself the Hebrew language. He was also studying at 13 Arabic and Persian. And some of his neighbors, who were wealthier than his family, learned about this, and they lent him grammars in Hebrew, in Chaldean, in Aramaic, in Samaritan, and Syriac. I mean, it's a lot of languages, all of which he mastered in his teenage years. He managed to get his hands on a glass grinding lathe and made lenses and made his own microscope to do investigation of plants. He read Joseph Priestley's book on air. Priestley was a very interesting man in his own right, who discovered what he called the dephlogisticated air, which you and I would call oxygen. Now, through his Quaker connections, he was recommended in London to David Barclay as a companion for Barclay's grandson, who was named Hudson Gurney. Barclay was a wealthy man and one of the originators of the Barclay banking system, which back in 1790 still existed and still exists, of course, today. He stayed with Gurney from age 13 to 18, what he called some of the most profitable years of his life with regard to mental and moral cultivation, as he put it. By 17, he was busily reading and working through Newton's Principia in Latin and Newton's Optics, which was, of course, in English. At age 15, he came down with tuberculosis, not uncommon in that day, and he was treated and cured by his great uncle, who was a well-known physician. His uncle, his great uncle, was a man of significance in London and a friend of many intellectuals, including Edmund Burke. And through his uncle, he had done translations. For example, here is a translation which you, so what? But this is a speech from Shakespeare's Henry VIII, which, and that's in his handwriting. It's translated from English into Greek by a 15-year-old kid. And this so impressed people, including Burke, that he became then known to some of the intellectuals in London. When he was ready for university, it was thought, of course, he would study classics. I mean, here's a kid who was quite fluent in classical Greek. Burke suggested he study law. He decided to study medicine. Medicine in his day was called physic, and not physics, but physic. And so he entered university at 19 years old, 1792, to study medicine. There were no medical schools as such in that day, and he went to St. Bartholomew's Hospital, where there were a regular series of medical lectures. He also enrolled himself in what is called the Hunter School of Anatomy in London, and at that school, they actually insisted, and this was quite rare in his day, that students dissect cadavers. And so one of the jobs of the students, of course, was to collect cadavers. And so they would spend a fair amount of time out by the hanging grounds at Tyburn. I would say hanging around the hanging grounds. they spent a lot of time collecting bodies there. They did some grave robbing and so forth. But he also dissected the eye of an ox, and this gave him a lot of interest in how the eye worked. And what he was particularly interested in is how the eye could focus on objects or accommodate, as people in the optical field say, how the eye could focus or accommodate on objects at different distances, here or back there. Now, the retina is fixed at the back of the eye and is in a fixed position. And light is absorbed here, converted from visible light into electrical signals conducted to the brain by the optical nerve. For us to see clearly, the light has to be focused sharply on the retina, and it is done so by the lens at the front of the eye. Light is focused most easily by doubly convex lenses. Now, these lenses are not doubly convex, and they are not because a doubly convex lens would be thicker and heavier and less sightly. And so people use concave-convex lenses, which don't focus as well as these do. And the normal human eye has a lens like this built into it. And how does the eye manage then to focus at different depths? And there are only two possible ways to do that. One is to move the lens physically back and forth. I certainly remember as a kid taking a magnifying glass and trying to read things or burn holes in paper. And when you do that, you move the magnifying glass back and forth to make sure things focus. Or if you have a camera and you rotate the lens, what you're doing is moving the lens back and forth with respect to either the film plane or the plane in digital cameras of CCDs. And that's one way to do it, and this way was suggested by Johannes Kepler back as far as 1611. The other way is to change the shape of that lens to make it thicker or thinner, and this was suggested first by René Descartes way back in 1637. Young proposed that the lens does change shape, and he said it probably changes shape because there are small muscular fibers inside the lens. Well, he was wrong about that, but it does change shape, and it changes shape because around the edges of the lens there are little small small muscles. Here I have a picture of, you can see that the doubly convex lens here is thinner for objects far away and thicker for objects that are close. The image that is projected onto the brain is a so-called real image. It actually appears on the retina. Real images from doubly convex lenses are upside down. And so all of the images that appear on our retina are upside down. When I look at you, you are, have your feet there. Okay. Now, of course, the brain learns quickly to turn that around. And I, from what I understand from my medical colleagues, newborn infants can't focus very well. It takes them a month or 6 weeks or something to really be able to focus sharply. And I'm assuming that the brain in that month learns to rotate objects so that mom doesn't look as if she's walking on the ceiling. You can get spectacles. I've tried this experiment. You can get spectacles with prisms, which will flip the image again, and the world looks upside down. And boy, that is very disturbing. And I'm told that if you wear them for a while, your brain will rotate things back. I wonder what happens. I've not tried this, but I wonder what happens if it goes from this to that, what happens when everything is sideways. Anyway, Young wrote a paper on this at 19 years old on the eye, and a year or so later he published it in the Philosophical Transactions, and this got him elected to the Royal Society in 1794, just past his 21st birthday. The idea that there are no 21-year-olds in the Royal Society today, to my knowledge. Now, he decided to continue his medical education by enrolling at Edinburgh University, which was then the most famous medical school most famous university with a medical school in Britain. There were no dissections, but there were lots of very good lectures. And one of the lecturers was a man named Joseph Black. Now, Joseph Black is also known to all beginning physics students because he did many experiments on the physics of heat, subject we call today thermodynamics. He discovered in particular the concept we call specific heat, which is the amount of heat energy that's necessary to change something by a given temperature amount. So that everybody knows, for example, if you put a pot of water on the stove, that the metal in the pot gets hot a lot faster than the water. That's because they have these materials have different specific heats. Water has a very high specific heat, which means it takes a lot of energy to change its temperature, whereas metal has a low specific heat, it's easy to change its temperature. Another of student, by the way, of James Joseph Black, was a young man named James Watt, who went on to invent the first practical steam engine, which made a huge difference to the Industrial Revolution in the 19th century. According to the great historian of medicine, Roy Porter, and I quote, "The strength of an Edinburgh education lay in imparting the elements of anatomy, surgery, chemistry, medical theory, and practice. Those falling sick in such diverse places as Newcastle, Newfoundland, or New South Wales would most probably have been seen by Edinburgh doctors." Now, Young left Edinburgh after a year, and he moved to Germany, where he enrolled himself in the University of Göttingen to continue his medical education. After less than a year there, he decided that he was ready to be examined. Now, that immediately, and I thought, Bosch not only did this guy speak about 15 Oriental languages, but he was going to medical school in German, and he passed his exams in German, so he must have spoken German quite well as all these other things. He passed this exam in April of 1796, publishing a thesis on the organs of the human voice, and so he became a doctor of physic, surgery, and midwifery. He wanted to go to Italy, as every sensible person does, but he couldn't because Napoleon was busy fighting wars there, so he traveled around in Germany. And one of the people he met there was the British ambassador to Berlin, who was Lord Elgin. And Lord Elgin then became ambassador to Greece, where he removed a large number of marbles and sent them to London. And even in his day, this was considered vandalism. Then finally, in 97, Young returned to England, having been away for about 2 years. Now he was 24 years old, and he couldn't practice medicine because the College of Physicians was dominated by men, and there were only men, of course, in those days, unfortunately. It was dominated by men who had all been to Oxford and Cambridge, and they set the rules. And one of the rules they made for a license was that in order to practice medicine, you had to have attended the same university for 2 years in a row. So going to Edinburgh for 1 year and Göttingen for 1 year was not adequate, and he couldn't practice. So he went off to Cambridge and enrolled himself at Emmanuel College and spent 2 years sitting in his room, because he didn't need to go to any lectures because he knew the stuff already. But he did. He read and he wrote and he did experiments. And a lot of his work was on the human voice. And I think perhaps that his work on sound, which is clearly a wave phenomenon, had probably something to do with his eventual work on light, where he proved that it was also a wave phenomenon. So he stayed there for 2 years, and that got him a license to practice. During his residency in Cambridge, his great uncle died, and he left him some money and a house, a nice house near Hyde Park, and so he was kind of set when he moved back to London. He constructed an instrument there called an optometer, by which he could measure the distance, the closest distance to which a human eye could focus. And this, for a normal eye, is about 10 inches, or for those of us who are more learned, 25.4 centimeters. Those of us who are as myopic as I am, you can focus closer than that. But he also was the very first person to discover the phenomenon of astigmatism. Astigmatism comes from the Greek word meaning not at a point, astigmatic. And this astigmatism is where the line, the eye focuses differently for vertical or horizontal lines. And he didn't get the reason for astigmatism right, but it comes because the lens is asymmetric, it's not perfectly round. Now, Young experimented on himself and he experimented on his own eye. And I really can't understand why in the world he would do this. Here was a man who was used to dissecting cadavers, why he didn't go off. He was at Marble Arch, he could have gone across the road, picked up a corpse from the hanging and cut out an eye, but he didn't. He took a pair of calipers. Now, calipers have very sharp points. So he attached to each end a brass ring. And then he put one side of the brass ring over here and one side of the brass ring over here, and he measured the width of his eye. He also measured the length of his eye by looking sideways and pushing one ring all the way back until he saw a bright spot, which told him, he thought, that it was the ring was close to the retina. He then put the other side on the cornea of his eye. I guess he must have had somebody hold the lid open, because normally if you put something in your eye, your lid will close. And he measured the width, the length of his eye. People who do these things seem to me pretty crazy, but his measurements were very good, and they coincide quite well with the modern numbers. Finally, he was able to practice medicine in London, but he was still 8 years away from being fellowship in the Royal College of Physicians. But he then, running out of money, he sold his uncle's fancy house and he moved to 48 Welbeck Street, where there's now a plaque. He moved there in 1801. Welbeck Street, by the way, and I like all this kind of stuff, so I look it up. It's named after Welbeck Abbey, which was the Portland family estate. And this area of Welbeck Street was part of the Portland-Cavendish family estates. Duke of Portland had married a Cavendish, and so they had a lot of real estate in that area. And it was constructed on the fields of the Earl of Oxford, which is why we have names like Oxford Street and Welbeck Street and Great Portland Street and Cavendish Square. And it was in Welbeck Street in 1802, he wrote that the eye, and the first person to do this, that the eye was sensitive to three primary colors, which he first said were red, yellow, and blue, later changed to red, green, and violet. And generally today we say that it's red, green, and blue. He published this result in the Philosophical Transactions, where it was completely forgotten. It was then rediscovered by Heinrich Helmholtz in 1859, but it was not until the 1950s that George Wald and his collaborators proved that really the cone cells of the eye are sensitive to three fundamental colors. Wald won the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 67. The eye has two kinds of cells in it that are sensitive to light. There are the rod cells, which are largely on the outside of the retina, and these are only sensitive to intensity, very sensitive to intensity, and so they really see only in black and white. There are also cone cells, which are the color cells, and they lie closer to the center of the retina. In these cone cells, there are molecules that are light sensitive, color sensitive. And what that means, if I can try to explain that, is that these molecules have electrons in them, and these electrons are capable of vibrating. And when they vibrate, they create an electrical signal. That electrical signal is transmitted by the optical nerve, goes back to the brain, and gives us a sensation of sight. Now, red, green, and blue light causes what is known in physics as a resonant phenomena, and maybe I can explain that. The analogy I normally use to try to explain this is a kid on a swing. If you're pushing, in my case, your grandchild on a swing, you pull the swing back and let it go, and it has a natural frequency with which it oscillates back and forth. Now, if you just don't push it anymore, it will stop due to friction. So you want to, and children don't like this, so of course I stand there and I push. Now, how do you push in order that they really swing a lot? Well, if I'm busy talking to this cute mom next door, I push every once in a while. But usually, I mean, the idea is that you push when the swing comes back, and that increases the amplitude of the swing. That's resonance. When you are pushing at the same frequency that the object would like to move, that's called resonance. And so these electrons, the blue electrons, if you will, the green electrons and the red electrons, each respond particularly well to red, green, or blue light. And any other color makes some combination, and the brain figures all of that out. Jung is then recognized as one of the first people ever to realize that the brain not only receives information, but processes and integrates information as well. Now, I want to mention a man who is going to hire Thomas Jung, a man named Count Rumford. In 1799, Rumford was living in London, and he founded the Royal Institution on Albemarle Street, very close to Piccadilly Circus. It's still there, and still a very interesting place. Since he was soon to be involved with Young, I want to talk about him for a little bit because he's an interesting person in his own right. He was born in the United States, or in what was then America, in a town, in a suburb of Boston called Woburn, Massachusetts. And he was born in March of 1753, and he died in Paris in 1814. Woburn, well, he was realized as a clever young kid, and he used to go with his older brother to lectures at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts, which is also a suburb of Boston. Now, Woburn to Cambridge, I looked up on a map. Of course, he walked, and that's very close by car, but it's 10 miles, and that's a long way by foot. And given that the winters in Massachusetts, they just had a major snowstorm yet again yesterday, it must have taken some courage to walk back and forth 10 miles each way. Now, he was a relatively poor man, but apparently very good looking. I have a picture of him later, which I'll show you, and you can decide for yourself. But he managed to find a widow older than himself who had a lot of money, and they married. And she came from New Hampshire, so he moved up to New Hampshire. And given that she had land, property, and money, he managed to achieve a much higher social position at that time. And it also, of course, made people envious, and it made him some enemies as well. One of the positions he had was as a major in the local militia. And shortly thereafter, 1775, the Revolutionary War broke out. And as a landed gentleman, he was on the British side, not the colonial side, the so-called Tory side of his time. And this made him even less popular. And so he ran away, left his wife, whom he never saw again, and their baby daughter, they had together. And he went to Boston to join the British Army. And he brought with him a lot of interesting information. And so they made him a major in the British Army as well. And then he was stationed down on Long Island, which the British also occupied. His job on Long Island was to supply food to the local population. And in particular, his job was to supply bread. Now, if you bake bread, you need an oven, and ovens have to be made out of brick or stone. And Long Island is all sand, so there are no stones. So he went to the local graveyard, and he took tombstones to build the oven. But being a thoughtful and kind person, when the Smith family got their bread, they're baked on the bottom of the bread. It said, Grandpa Smith, and every family got a loaf of bread personally engraved. Interesting man. At the end of the war, he ran off to England, and because of his military service, he managed to get himself a job as deputy minister in the Department of War. This is a position he held until 1785. And there he designed weapons and explosives and warships and all sorts of things. He was a clever man. In 1785, he moved to Bavaria, where he had a dual role in the working for the government in weapons again, and that's why he's famous, and also for the local populace, what we call in Britain the Home Office. Now, his job for the Home Office was to take care of the poor, and as you know, he's a very kind person. So he established a workhouse, and his job there was to, or what he needed to do, was to provide clothing and blankets and so forth. And he took them from the local hospital where people had died of contagious diseases. This, of course, reduced the expenditures of the Home Office, and he saved a great deal of money for the government, making himself even more popular. On the more positive side, he designed and caused to be built the Englischer Garten in Munich, which is one of the largest and most wonderful public gardens in the world. But it was in his working with artillery that he is so famous and remembered today. In making artillery, they take a big billet of brass and then they drill it out to make the barrel. Now, when you drill, of course, the friction makes things hot. And so chips would come off and they'd be very warm. And he would take so and so many grams, X grams, of chips, and he would put it in Y grams of water and make the water boil. Now this was remarkable. People would come from court to watch this because there was no fire. He didn't have a flame to make water boil. He made water boil with chips. But what he found, and being very clever, was that the same number of chips, the same weight of chips, would boil the same weight of water, whether it was from the beginning of the barrel or from the end of the barrel. Now, this was unusual because the 18th century was a century in which people believed in fluids. For example, electricity was considered to be two fluids called resinous and aqueous fluids. And there are two fluids. I mean, they're called protons and electrons, but we call them different things. This came from the kind of stuff you rubbed to make charges. There were no batteries, so there were only static charge available in those days. Fire was thought to be the consumption of a fluid called phlogiston, Priestley was the guy who discovered dephlogisticated air. And phlogiston was this fluid that was fire, because you carry in a big heavy log to your fireplace, and you carry out just a handful of ash, which doesn't weigh nearly as much. Where did all the weight go? Phlogiston up the chimney. Heat was thought to be a fluid called caloric. But now, if heat is caloric, which is being generated and used up as you bore the cannon out, there shouldn't be as much caloric left at the end of the tube as there was at the beginning. And since there was the same amount of heat, it couldn't be caloric. Hence, the end of that theory. So he's very well known for that. Now, he moved back to London in 17, whenever it was. Anyway, he moved back to London at some point, 1796. And I have there is his picture as painted by Thomas Gainsborough. And I guess you can decide for yourself whether he was handsome enough to lure a rich widow. Now, he continued to do research, and he was very interested in practical inventions. He invented the drip coffee pot. He invented the double boiler. And in particular, he invented the Rumford fireplace. The Rumford fireplace was very popular in his day and became very popular again in the 70s amongst the hippies in the United States, because they lived out in the country and they needed fireplaces. They didn't have central heating. And these are very efficient fireplaces. Here is a picture of a Rumford fireplace, and it's different than the normal fireplace. It has sloped sides, which reflect the heat out better into the room. And it has a narrow middle, and the chimney is narrow. And the purpose of having a narrow chimney means that the updraft is much greater, so you get less smoke coming out into the room. And because there's a greater flow of air, the colder the wood burns at a better rate. And so all of that really was very propitious. Now, at the turn of the century, since he was interested in practical science, whereas the Royal Society was not so much, he and the president of the Royal Society, Joseph Banks, formed the Royal Institution. And he supplied actually most of the money to support it, and he hired as the first director Humphrey Davy, a very fine chemist, a very famous man, and it was a very wise choice. But he was also deeply interested in getting science out to the public, and so he made it a requirement for the director to hold regular public lectures. And these are still being held. They are now called the BBC Christmas Lecture Series to this day, and are extremely popular. In 1802, he left London for Paris under rather unusual circumstances because he'd been accused of embezzlement of funds, which was probably true. There, his wife had died in America, and so he met there the widow of a very great chemist, French chemist, Antoine Lavoisier. Lavoisier had been beheaded during the terror, not because he was a chemist, but because his daytime job was as a tax collector, and that wasn't very popular. So they married, but that marriage must have been quite tempestuous and was certainly the source of a great deal of gossip, because it only lasted a year, and then he disappeared. His daughter, Sarah, had come to Europe because her mother was dead, and he was her financial support, not very generous father, unfortunately. But anyway, to come back to Thomas Young, Joseph Banks in 1801 or 1801 suggested Young as a professor of natural philosophy to Rumford, and that's what he was appointed. And his new responsibilities were very serious, and they also involved giving public lectures. Now, Young may have been a great prodigy, but he was apparently an appalling lecturer. He was described by somebody as being narcoleptically boring. sounds just like some of my professors at the university. So he only stayed in this position for 2 years, returning to medicine, and he was also appointed as foreign secretary for the Royal Society. Now, Young's greatest contribution to physics was his work on light, and that's what I want to talk about now. So what is light? Well, light comes in colors, it travels in straight lines, it reflects from shiny surfaces, and when it goes from one transparent medium to another, air to glass, water to glass, etc., it bends, it changes direction, something called, known as refraction, to use the proper Latin term. Now, the fact that light travels in straight lines led most people, Newton especially, to believe that light was composed of a stream of particles, because particles travel in straight lines. When they bounce off a surface, they reflect. However, these have to be very peculiar particles, because they need to be able to pass through one another. After all, you can take two light beams and they will cross. They pass through one another, and so that's a very strange particle. However, the alternative theory, namely that light is a wave, is even stranger, because waves behave in very peculiar ways. They do not travel in straight lines. They spread out in ripples, and they bend around corners or obstacles in the water. So that, for example, I know sound is a wave because I can hear around the corner. But how can light be a wave? Because I can't see around the corner. So that was the argument at the time. And this convinced Newton, certainly, that light was, in fact, a particle phenomenon. Now, here I have a picture out of a standard physics textbook where I have a surface, an air-water interface surface, and I have an incident ray, and I have a reflective ray, and I have a refractive ray. And angles with light are never measured with respect to the surface, but always with respect to this vertical line perpendicular to the surface called the normal line. Now, the angle of incidence and the angle of reflection are equal one to the other, something that was well known to the Greeks. However, there is a relationship between the angle of incidence and the angle of refraction, which requires trigonometry to write down in a mathematical formula. And so it wasn't discovered until the Dutchman Willebrod Snell in 1621 wrote down the relationship, the trigonometric relationship between those two angles. Now, with more modern research, we know that the same formula was discovered in Baghdad at the Abbasid court in 984, a long time ahead before. Now, the light bends closer to the normal when it is refracted into water or glass. Newton said, well, if it is pulled closer to the normal, that requires a force. And Newton said that anything that require that where there's a force involved, it involves also an acceleration, and so the speed should change, increase. And that means this light ray goes faster than that light ray. The wave theory, by the way, says exactly the opposite, namely that this light ray goes slower than that light ray. But of course, light travels at 300 million meters per second. And so in 1704, when Newton wrote his optics book, nobody could measure that speed. So this was not a definitive test for anything. Newton had said that that light consisted of particles. Newton, to the 18th century, was the king of physics. And what he said was true, whether or not there was any experimental proof. And so everybody believed that light was a series of particles, except Thomas Young. So he began investigating in 1797 light. And he knew that sound waves are, in fact, waves. Now, waves can overlap in various ways, so that there are two ways in which sound waves can overlap. Okay? One wave is the following, and it is, here I have, at the top, I have a sound wave of a given frequency, bouncing up and down, and underneath in the middle, there is a sound wave of a slightly greater frequency, ever so slightly different. And if I add the two together, at every point I add the amplitude of the number two to the amplitude of number one, what I get is a wave pattern that looks like this. And so if I listen to these two together, what I hear is wrong, 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 wrong. Those of you who have ever flown on jet aircraft will often know that we'll often hear a sound like that coming from the floor. In fact, you can feel it as well as hear it. And this is because the engines are rotating at very high speed, and the captain tries to get them rotating at exactly the same frequency, but it's never quite perfect. And so you get this beat frequency at about one cycle between the two rapidly rotating engines in a two-engine aircraft. I actually have a sound clip of that, and if I have time, I'll play that for you. Now, alternatively, you can have a different thing. You can have two sources of sound of the same frequency, but at different locations. And what will happen there is that sound comes from there, sound comes from there. I tried to do this, it didn't work, but the room isn't big enough, technical reasons. You know, when I studied at school, when I studied science, we used to say that you can tell it's biology if it is green and slimy, and you can tell if it's chemistry if it stinks, and you can tell it's physics if it doesn't work. This didn't work. I spent about a half an hour trying to make it work. But the room isn't big enough. But if you have sound coming from these two, then this sound wave and that sound wave will overlap. And at certain places in the room, the crest of one wave will meet the crest of another wave, and it'll be really loud. And at another place, just a little bit off to the side, the crest of a wave will overlap with the trough of a wave, and you'll hear nothing at all. And so you could move your head. I've actually done this in rooms. If I had speakers that were this far apart as opposed to 10 meters, I could show you that. But you can actually then move your head around and the sound will be loud here and very soft there. And that's called the interference. Now, Young wondered if it would be possible to make beats. This is called beat frequency, this thing, to make beats with light. And the answer is yes, if it's the year 2000, but no, if it's the year 1797. And the reason is, with sound, you can take a wave of 400 cycles per second, or hertz as they are now called, and you can take another wave of 403 hertz, for example, and you will get a beat frequency of about 6 cycles per second. But light has a frequency of about, the kind we can see, has a frequency of about 600 trillion hertz. And so you need a wave of 600 trillion and another wave of 600 trillion and three, and then you will get blink, 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 blink from them. That's very hard to do. And so it took very high-tech stuff. But, so you can't make beats easily with light, but what you can do is you can interfere with light. You can have two sources of light, and they will overlap in ways such that you get bright light at certain places and not so bright light at other places. Now, I want to stop here for the day, but I want to see if I can't play this beat frequency thing for you just for kicks.
So this experiment, I'm going to demonstrate beat frequency and what it looks like and what it sounds like. So the first graph right here is showing a 500 hertz sine wave. The second graph here is currently also showing a 500 hertz sine wave, but I'm going to change that frequency. And I'm adding those two signals together to get this graph here. And this bottom graph here is the fast Fourier transform showing the frequency content of that signal. So when the frequencies are both the same, they happen to be adding together. So right now I get single sine wave output that's at 500 hertz. If I increase my second frequency here to 501, you can start to hear a beat.
That's a beat frequency.
Approximately 1 hertz, which is the difference between the two frequencies of the signals coming in. And you can see the resulting addition of those two signals is this sort of pulsating sine wave. And you can see the amplitude of the frequency response is also pulsating. So if you increase this to 502, now I got a beat frequency of 2 hertz. If you go much, much higher, you can start to see the actual beat frequency sort of overlaid on top of the carrier frequency, which is, I guess, 500 hertz. If I drop this way down to, say, 200 hertz, now I have a 500 hertz signal added, so a 200 hertz signal gives me this sine wave coming out. You can definitely see two separate peaks on the frequency response representing those two sine waves.
Anyway, I just wanted to be able to show you that. And this, what you saw there was exactly this pattern right here. Anyway, tomorrow we will talk about Young's experiment for interference, but also, remember Young, man of science, on that blue plaque, and I want to tell you about some of the other things that he did, including, just an enormous number of things, but in particular his work on deciphering the Rosetta Stone, which was very, very significant and led to a lot of things. So if there are questions or so, I'm happy to try to answer anything that I possibly can. And if not, we can adjourn and meet again tomorrow if you can brave the traffic. Let me get the one in the back. Yes, sir.
How did Bronson become a count? How did this American become a count?
How did
he was in Bavaria, and because he was able to save a lot of money by killing all these poor people, the Elector of Bavaria made him a count. There was a count of the Holy Roman Empire, which the joke is that it isn't holy, it isn't Roman, it isn't an empire. He became a count. Now, when you're a count, you have to be the count of somebody or other. And so he had lived in Concord, New Hampshire, which in those days was called Rumford, New Hampshire. And so he became the Reichskopf of Rumford, or in English, the count Rumford. That's how he got the name. Thank you, Mr. I get involved in other things. I get involved. Now, this gentleman had a question over here.
Your beat frequency, I thought you could only hear above 50 hertz, not down as low as 100.
Well, I'm not sure. The question is about hearing beat frequencies, and I'm not sure exactly what you mean. The human ear, not my ear, because my ear is in terrible shape, but the human ear, for a young person, can hear anything from 20 hertz to about 20,000 hertz. Dogs, of course, hear up to 25,000 hertz, 30,000 hertz, and bats up to 50,000 or something. So we can hear virtually any sound in that region. And what you're hearing in the beep, you can hear beat frequencies of anything where you can hear the actual sound. But I'm not sure what you mean by 50 hertz.
I can hear down to 50 hertz.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But
you're hearing the beat, you're hearing the difference between two frequencies that are several hundred hertz. And so the tone that you hear, the bum, is probably around 400 hertz. No, it's lower than that. Probably around 300 hertz. And that's the tone that you're hearing, and then you're hearing the changes in the amplitude of that tone between, say, 300 and 302 or something like that. And you're hearing that pulsation sound. Anything else? Yes, sir.
Young's modulus.
Oh, yes, indeed. I will mention that tomorrow.
Will you?
It's the same Young.
Same
Young. Absolutely. I mean, the number... tomorrow I will tell you. He wrote some 63 articles, I think, for the Encyclopedia Britannica on a huge range of subjects. Huge. Just amazing. He was really, really was a polymath, this guy. A real person who knew an enormous number of different fields. Okay, well, if there's nothing else we can...
Gentlemen, yeah. Is the child. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just wanted to, apropos of the last week's lecture about combining poetry and,
oh yes,
and we're speaking of he who in America is called Cowper and who in England is called Cooper.
Yes.
I went home and I dutifully got out my little, what I'll say, wish traveling Cooper. Leather-bound little thing obviously went in your bag.
Take care of
your companion on the train.
It's really interesting. I find this Scottish pronunciation because David Hume, whose name is spelled H-O-M-E, changed it to H-U-M-E when he moved to London because people couldn't pronounce it. But one of his distant relatives, Alec Douglas Hume, who was Prime Minister, kept the original spelling, and people learned to pronounce it properly.
Correct. Well, I mean, English, anybody can be, nobody can be blamed for that. I mean, the English company half their money back. And the other interesting thing which came to mind, and you mentioned him today, that was Faraday. When my father died, and among the things he had in his library in Oregon, bear in mind that he was born before the First World War and so on, and he was an engineer. So one thing he said was electricity. Well, he had, and my sister now has it in Canada, seven volumes of Faraday's, entire leather-bound of Faraday's electrical experiments.
Amazing.
I'm not sure that it was the first edition or what it was, but I can't remember. I must ask my sister. But it was an amazing work, and he actually had to read it and study it.
Well, Faraday is my hero. He was a remarkable man.
Yes.
Very little education, but he was a great genius. I mean, he left school at 12 or 13. But he was such an orderly person. I'm not orderly at all, so I have great respect for him. He numbered paragraphs in his books, and so he could refer later on to paragraph 3,472, where I showed
But I think, you know, you use your term polymath. I mean, I think, and you yourself say how you find all these things interesting. I mean, I'm just a mere dilettante. I find everything.
So
I find art fascinating, language, architecture, music.
Absolutely.
I mean, I collect all kinds of things from early chamber music right through to Philip Glass and all this kind of stuff. You know. And everything kind of interests you.
Yeah, no, it really does. It really does. I used to have trouble with this with my physics colleagues. Because, again, in this business about being a specialist, you're not being serious about it. First, you like to teach, which is very bad because that takes time away from your research. And then you're interested in this other stuff.
And you start off and you go off.
But
everything is connected with everything.
Absolutely. And it's such fun.
Yeah.
And that's what I love about the British Library in particular, because then I read something and then I get up and I walk over and I find a reference to that. And I just branch out.
Well, that's kind of one's favorite building. If they said, where would you need to be locked in for the rest of your life?
Oh, God.
British Library, anyway.
Absolutely. If I could,
you'd never get through it then.
If I could go occasionally to Wigmore Hall, though.
Yeah, occasionally, yeah.
But that would be perfect for me. Absolutely.
Anyway, see you tomorrow.
Thanks very much. Hi.
I wonder if you could just serve something for me. You're playing Newtonian mechanics.
Yes.
If you're moving a weight from there to there, it always takes a certain amount of energy, the same amount of energy, no matter by what means you do it. Is that true? If you do it quickly, it takes more power.
Yes.
If you do it slowly, it takes less power.
That's
but it
correct.
Always takes the same amount of energy.
If what you're talking about is the difference of gravitational potential energy, that is true. Because moving this way takes no energy because you're doing no work against gravity. So that all that matters is this height difference. Now, if there's friction involved,